HiBridge Audio presents The Chaos Imperative, How Chance and Disruption Increase Innovation, Effectiveness, and Success, by Ori Braffman and Judah Pollack. Read by Drew Birdsey. Original material, copyright 2013, Shekinah Inc. Recorded by arrangement with Crown Business, an imprint of Crown Publishing Group, a division of Random House Inc. Recording copyright 2013, HiBridge Company. Introduction. The bottom line. Ron Ricci at Cisco Systems claims there are two types of communicators in life: the upfront bottom line crew and the people who like to tell a good story and provide you with the evidence before arriving at their thesis. Ron refers to the two groups as deductive communicators and inductive communicators, respectively. I am an inductive communicator, I've come to realize. I typically hate jumping straight to the bottom line, especially in a book about chaos, of all things. I much prefer making my case with a good story. But for all you deductive communicators out there, here is the bottom line up front. We all need what I call contained chaos in our lives and careers. We can gain immeasurably from conducting a meeting with absolutely no agenda or from bringing unusual suspects into the fold. My research has shown that a certain amount of chaos supports what I call organized serendipity, where new and creative ideas seem to emerge out of nowhere. Surprisingly, chaos makes us more effective in our careers. It makes for better school systems, more innovative businesses, and as my work with the U.S. Army has shown, even a more resilient military. So that's the bottom line. Now let me tell you a story. Chapter 1. Harnessing Chaos. Make it matter. I was sitting in an office with General Martin Dempsey months before he became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He wanted to know if I could help him. In his late 50s, with close-cropped white hair and wearing his combat uniform, Dempsey certainly looked the part of a top military officer. But as I began talking to him, he didn't exactly fit the stereotype I had in my mind. He's affable, well-versed in literature and the classics, soft-spoken, down-to-earth, and quick to smile. I met General Dempsey in his office at Fort Monroe, Virginia. It was a long, rectangular room in which every wall was decorated with plaques, ceremonial swords, and photos taken on the battlefield. 3 days earlier, I had been sitting on a Northern California lawn overlooking an organic garden, wearing shorts and flip-flops, and talking to my San Francisco friends about the importance of setting a vibe at a music campout, where several hundred people take to the woods, hauling a bunch of speakers and power sources with them, and DJs spin in the forest. Now here I was, still a little sunburned, on a military base on the East Coast. There was nothing touchy-feely about the swords hanging on the wall. The steel was sharp, spotless, and very real. I felt more than a little out of place. My only prior exposure to the military had come from watching Hollywood's war movies and from seeing soldiers carrying Uzis when I was a young kid in Israel, before my family moved to the United States. My father was such a poor fit for the Israeli military that he was assigned to a kibbutz for his compulsory service and spent his time harvesting bananas. I majored in peace and conflict studies at the University of California at Berkeley. I live in San Francisco, and I'm a vegan. Walking to General Dempsey's office that morning, I'd realized that I didn't know any of the proper etiquette. Do you salute a general? You don't if you're a civilian. Do you call him sir? I called him Marty. Do you monitor your language? I didn't, and neither did he. I hadn't even known what the four stars on a general's uniform meant. I had to look it up on Wikipedia. We sat across from each other on comfortable brown leather couches. It was an informal meeting, but just a few feet away, seven members of his uniform staff were taking copious notes. It was as if a team of highly trained soldiers, ready to respond to any situation or surprise attack, were documenting your visit to your uncle's house. "I was on a trip," he told me, "reading your first book, The Starfish and the Spider, and I immediately turned to one of my officers and said that I really wanted to meet you because I think you can help me with something very important." I'd later learned that as I was living my life in San Francisco, people in the highest echelons of the Pentagon were using my theories to try to understand how to counter terrorism and how to dramatically change the nature of the military, but more on that in a bit. As Dempsey and I talked about his time as one of the top commanders in charge of the Iraq War, I noticed a rectangular wooden box about the size of a shoebox on the coffee table between us. There was something about it that captured my attention. It was simple, but carefully constructed, and it was one of the only objects in the room that was closed. I asked him what was inside. It turned out that the box's contents represented the reason he was asking for my help.